Productions. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which we are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is Sunday, January 17, 2010, and Bill Fink is joining us for the next installment of Russia Number 1. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh. So last week, where did we leave off?
Well, report number 20. I'm going to pick right up with it. General Poole to the War Office. Now he's reporting that the Bolsheviks, and this is January 8th, 1919, he's reporting that the Bolsheviks are now employing gangs of Chinese for the purpose of killing officers and deserters. Peasants have been killed by these gangs for refusing to comply with requisitioning decrees. And even the families of officers serving here have been murdered. So even the families of officers serving in the army have been murdered by the gangs of Chinese. I did some research on the Chinese thing, and it's a crying shame, but the best source I came up with outside of one was actually Wikipedia. That there are very few honest sources on the there's very few honest sources on the Bolshevik Revolution. And Wikipedia is not one of them. I mean, let's face it, we live in a Jew-controlled world. And this Russia Number 1 report, it is absolutely draws a much more horrendous picture of the rise of Bolshevism in the Soviet Union in Russia than anything that we find in most mainstream presses. I mean, I saw articles today that virtually glorified Lenin and Stalin. And it's on the internet, and it's American websites, and it's crazy. That's how many brainwashed people we have out there. I did find one article on Nestor Makhno, who was a Ukrainian anarchist that led something. He organized and led something called the Black Army. And this article says that the Bolsheviks had used Chinese and Estonian and Lettish forces against him, okay? But Wikipedia admits that there were tens of thousands of Chinese in the Bolshevik army. But then it kind of downplays that by saying that, well, that's out of an army of maybe up to 1.8 million people, so that's really not very many. But evidently there were a lot of Chinese laborers in Tsarist Russia who were admitted to work, just like we have a Mexican problem, and the Jews use those Chinese laborers against the Russian population, just like they do here. It's the same pattern over and over again. It was probably Jews that rattled the cages to get them let in as workers, looking for cheap labor. I wouldn't doubt it one bit. But the Chinese were used in large numbers against the Russian population because they have no connection. And Lenin had even admitted at one point that it was to avoid fraternization. In other words, he would use aliens against the Russian people because the Russians wouldn't do what he wanted them to do.
So that's why, without a doubt, the Jews have brought in about 100 to 150 million non-whites into this country, so they have a huge fifth column ready to do their bidding.
Well, there's no doubt at all that when things get hot and heavy here, and they will, because these neo-Bolsheviks, I'll call them, these Bolsheviks in the Obama administration definitely have plans that they definitely have plans to change this, the face of this, the structure of this country forever. And when they try to bring those plans into fruition, they will use the other races against the white Christians. There is no doubt, just like they did in Bolshevik Russia.
In fact, didn't they do that?
What they did in 1917 and 1920 in Russia was very fast. And here they're doing the same thing, but they're doing it very slowly. Yeah, you know, Kevin MacDonald has an excellent article on his website, Organized Jewry Opposes Free Speech. As we see since maybe the last 20 years, as the Jews consolidate their power in both parties, the Democrat and the Republican, and their control over the media, they have been slowly, the people that cried in favor of free speech for so many years are now the most dead set against it. And they are the leaders of the hate crime bills, the ADL and the ACLU. They want to see these hate crime bills passed. They want to suppress free speech. They want to prevent people from speaking out about this or speaking out about that. And it's basically the same thing they did in the Soviet Union or in Tsarist Russia, but with much violent force. Here they are doing it in, over the long march, to use one of their favorite terms, in a very slow political process.
Yes.
But by training the body of people through the media, most people are brainwashed and have just gone along to a great degree with the political process that they're employing and have not offered serious resistance. And when they take the guns away from citizens here and flood us with enough aliens to do their bidding, well, which they really already have, then here you will see the same exact things that have happened in Bolshevik Russia. The satanic sacrifice of millions of white Christians. That's the real Holocaust. And the truth about Bolshevik Russia is suppressed here, so that when the Jews get the opportunity, and they will get the opportunity because the truth is suppressed, they'll be able to do it again. I have an abstract of a paper. I just put this on the front page of Christogenia today. I have an abstract from a paper written by Cass Sunstein, a Jewish lawyer who was a law academic at Harvard. And he writes this. He's also in the Obama administration. He writes this. Many millions of people hold conspiracy theories. They believe that powerful people have worked together in order to withhold the truth about some important practice or some terrible event. A recent example is the belief, widespread in some parts of the world, that the attacks of 9/11 were carried out not by Al-Qaeda, but by Israel or the United States. Now, not for nothing, I'm going to take a little departure. And ProThink has on his 9/11missinglinks.com website, he has all these Jews celebrating and dancing in the streets of New Jersey when the Twin Towers fall. I didn't see any reports of Arabs dancing in the streets in New Jersey when the Twin Towers fell.
Interestingly enough, it turned out that the Israelis who were dancing were actually Mossad operatives, and they demanded to be immediately released.
Well, right, absolutely. I'm going to continue with Cass Sunstein. Those who subscribe to conspiracy theories may create serious risks, including risks of violence, and the existence of such theories raises significant challenges for policy and law. The first challenge is to understand the mechanisms by which conspiracy theories prosper. The second challenge is to understand how such theories might be undermined. Here we have Operation COINTELPRO all over again, because that's what they're going to try. And that's probably what they're doing today. Such theories typically spread as a result of identifiable cognitive blunders. I'll give you a cognitive blunder. How come nobody noticed that the Jews pulled off 9/11? Okay. Operating in conjunction with informational and reputational influences, a distinctive feature of conspiracy theories is their self-sealing quality. Conspiracy theorists are not likely to be persuaded by an attempt to dispel their theories. They may even characterize that very attempt as further proof of the conspiracy, because those who hold conspiracy theories typically suffer from crippled epistemology, which is, you know, what they believe. It's a belief system. In accordance with which it is, and I guess Christianity, and according to Cass Sunstein, would probably be a crippled epistemology. In accordance with which it is rational to hold such theories, the best response consists in cognitive infiltration of extremist groups, various policy dilemmas, such as the question whether it is better for government to rebut conspiracy theories or to ignore them, are explored in this light. So Cass Sunstein is basically promoting government infiltration of conspiracy theory groups.
Well, do you think that's what was going on with what ProThink was talking about the whole...
Well, I believe it's been going on all along, and maybe he don't even realize it's been going on. Operation COINTELPRO is from the 70s.
Yes, well, I think
it goes maybe older than that. Excuse me?
I think it goes back to the 60s, COINTELPRO. That's when the FBI started. They would form their own clans and get people that were genuinely interested in the real Klan to join one of their fake clans. They would harass local Klan leaders by sending them letters supposedly from women to try and wreck their marriages and cause strife with their own families. And
well, did they ever form their own left-wing groups?
Yes, a few.
I'm amazed.
And I'd like to say, too, what you were talking about the movement against free speech, both parties favor free speech, and now we see liberals that supposedly, I'm sorry, they favor restrictions on free speech. We see liberals wanting speech restrictions in regards to hate crimes issues, and we see the so-called self-styled conservatives that say unpatriotic speech needs to be curtailed, and they just happen to define us as unpatriotic since we won't support their wars for Israel.
Well, right. You know, basically... Once, you know, the founders of this nation believed that those basic rights that are only partially enumerated in the Bill of Rights, that they came from God. And because those rights were granted to men by God, then no man could take away another man's rights.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you think that your rights come from the government, which is basically what most people think today, then the government has a right to take your rights away.
Absolutely.
And as soon as one man allows another man to impose one bit on anybody's rights, then that man doesn't deserve any himself. That's mm-hmm. the way it is.
And now they have this so-called fairness doctrine under which we would have to invite communists onto this program. Well, there's such a thing as equal time, which I don't believe in. You know, the people are here to listen to us speak about the topic at hand. If they want to hear communists speak, they'll go find a chat call hosted by communists.
Well, right, absolutely. The entire equal time thing is ridiculous because it really boils down to a confiscation of property. And I don't agree that, you know, we should have allowed the Jews to buy up our entire media, but imposing equal time on any media outlet actually is a confiscation of property.
Yes, and it's a theft of an audience.
Well, that too. It's like Russell Walker sitting here and promoting his garbage in the forum and demanding free speech. It's the same thing.
So the Jew simply uses the freedoms of our society to entrench himself and inculcate himself, and then he's going to consolidate and abolish all those freedoms when he no longer needs them.
Well, absolutely. That's the game plan. That's exactly what they've been doing. That's why the ACLU and the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center and all that's why they're at the vanguard of the hate crimes legislation. Because mm-hmm. the hate crimes legislation is basically a restriction and a diminishing of the free speech that we've enjoyed.
The ACLU would say that a man can have sex with a dog in a public park as long as he considers it a form of artistic expression.
Well, right, and that's not a hate crime.
But I can't hold up a sign that says, you know, run the money lenders out of New York City.
I guess they would figure that's a love crime. Yeah, you know, having sex with your dog, that's protected by free speech. And actually, the First Amendment, it's not in the Bill of Rights because to protect nice speech. Nice speech does not have to be protected. It's meant to protect opposite political speech. It's meant to protect challenges to the status quo in the government. It's not meant to protect nice speech. Nice speech doesn't have to be protected. And the Romans didn't kill, and the Jews didn't want to kill the apostles because they were speaking peace, love, and joy, believe me.
Well, if they were saying something that everyone wanted to hear, they would be lauded. They would become mega church pastors, wouldn't they?
Well, absolutely. Okay, the bottom line with the report, with report number 20, it is that the Bolsheviks were using Chinese and also Lithuanians and Estonians, and we've seen that, against the native Russians. And they did that because they knew that the Chinese and the Letts and the Estonians would be just as barbaric against an alien people as the Bolsheviks wanted them to be. It was actually a foreign invasion. The Bolsheviks were foreign invaders themselves.
Absolutely. None of them had any ties or connections to Russia, certainly not the Russian people.
Well, they were Jews, and most of them had been expelled from Russia in 1905 or fled Russia in 1905 and came back with lots of money to buy themselves a revolution.
That very fact that they'd been expelled after their first failed revolution, doesn't that show that the Tsar was far from bloodthirsty but overly merciful? Generally, if you're involved in a failed rebellion or a failed revolt against your country and your government, you're hanged, aren't you?
Well, right, and a lot of them, I believe, fled before they had that, before that alternative was a possibility.
But they were organizing quite openly, as we've already shown in the last several shows.
Right, they were absolutely organizing right out in the open. The Bolshevik press was operating right out in the open. They were anti-government right out in the open, and it shows that Tsarist Russia was definitely not a tyranny, like the Jews tried to portray it today. And that propaganda is all over the internet.
They were openly calling for the overthrow of the Tsar and the destruction of the government.
Right. But yeah, but you know, that's one of the planks, I like to call them planks because it surely is an official program of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. We will rewrite history.
And they have.
That's exactly what's happening. Brainwashing. Protocol number 16. We shall change history. That's it. And that's exactly what they've done again and again. Okay, you want to move on to 21?
Just before...
Before we depart, I have an article that's supposed to be a very... It's supposed to be a very academic article on a Cheka, which mentions actually absolutely nothing about Chinese and other alien forces in Russia, which were employed, and they were employed by the Cheka. And in fact, the guards, Lenin and Trotsky, used Chinese guards. They did not use Russian guards. They used Chinese troops for guards. Personal guards.
All right. Number 21. General Poole to the War Office. Received January 12. Dispatch telegraphic January 11, 1919. From intercepted radios and leaflets, it is clear that to allay hostility abroad, Bolsheviks are conducting double campaign. Leaflets are distributed among German troops, while decrees which are not intended to be put into force and appeals are radioed to Berlin, which show Bolsheviks in sufficiently liberal light to bring them into line with German socialists. Appeals to unite and force worldwide revolution are made at the same time to proletariats. It is manifest from numerous deserters and refugees from Central Russia. Efforts to destroy social and economic life of country have not abated. There is evidence to show that commissariats of free love have been established in several towns and respectable women flogged for refusing to yield. Decree for nationalization of women has been put into force and several experiments made to nationalize children. I trust His Majesty's government will not allow peace conference to be influenced by Bolshevik presentation of their case abroad, as their action at home is diametrically opposed to this. End report, and I would now like to read from the Communist Manifesto. the bourgeois claptrap about the family and education, about the hallowed correlation of parent and child, becomes all the more disgusting, the more, by the action of modern industry. All family ties among the proletarian are torn asunder, and their children transformed into simple articles of commerce and instruments of labor. But you communists would introduce community of women, screams the whole bourgeoisie in chorus. The bourgeois sees in his wife a mere instrument of production. He hears that the instruments of production are to be exploited in common, and naturally can come to no other conclusion than that the lot of being common to all will likewise fall to the women. He has not even a suspicion that the real point is to do away with the status of women as mere instruments of production. For the rest, nothing is more ridiculous than the virtuous indignation of our bourgeois at the community of women which they pretend is to be openly and officially established by the communists. The communists have no need to introduce community of women. It has existed almost from time immemorial. Our bourgeois, not content with having the wives and daughters of their proletarians at their disposal, not to speak of common prostitutes, take the greatest pleasure in seducing each other's wives. Bourgeois marriage is in reality a system of wives in common, and thus at the most what the communists might possibly be reproached with is that they desire to introduce, in substitution for a hypocritically concealed, an openly legalized community of women. For the rest, it is self-evident that the abolition of the present system of production must bring with it the abolition of the community of women springing from that system.
The Bolsheviks are making a false claim, a generalized blanket claim that all middle-class white men are screwing each other's wives.
Yes.
When they say that the bourgeois marriage system is a system of wives in common.
Mm-hmm. They're saying that it's basically everybody is out wife swapping on a regular basis.
Right. It's a patent lie. I mean, sure, it happens. Sometimes guys cheat on their wives and wives, but it's a patent blanket lie. And they're using that to justify their destruction of the family.
Absolutely, since they know the family is a major hurdle in their way to totally overthrowing a society's culture.
And the race in total, because that's what they're really after.
Mm-hmm.
Go on.
Oh, well, just two more words, i.e. of prostitution, both public and private. They consider marriage a form of prostitution. That's worth noting, isn't it?
Well, that's the typical demented Jewish mind. There's no doubt. And you pick up the Josephus and track the marriages of Herod. And they were consistently divorced, remarried, screwing around on their wives, cheating, marrying their nieces, marrying their sisters, marrying their, I'm sure in some cases they probably married their nephews, just not officially.
Well, Rothschilds were famous for that, uncles marrying nieces, yet they accused us of being incestuous.
So were the Herods.
Mm-hmm.
The Herods were consistent. Herod's brother married Herod's daughter, Herod's brother Philip. Herod the Great's brother Philip married two of Herod's daughters. And he married Philip's daughters. They were marrying their nieces all the time.
It seems that they frequently accuse us of what they themselves are doing.
They always accuse us of what they themselves are doing. Everything that they accused Hitler of in World War II falsely, they did in Bolshevik Russia. And probably 10 times worse, because it was on a much larger scale. If there were 300 million Jews in Europe, they would have accused Hitler of killing 290 million of them. But they can't make such a ridiculous claim, so they settle for 6 million.
And they accuse us of exploiting children when they are the primary exploiters of children. And I'd like to read one quick line or a paragraph here from F. Roderick Stoltheim, The Riddle of the Jews' Success. This came out of Germany in the mid-20s. Is that all right if I read from here?
Sure.
In the circle of my more intimate Jewish friends, the conversation turned almost exclusively upon women and sexual matters. They preferred to boast about the various tricks and artifices which they had employed in order to seduce innocent girls. And in no case did any one of them display the slightest trace of being conscience-smitten. It was regarded as a matter of course that the female servants must be at the disposal of the men in the Jewish household. "We just got a new servant," announced one. "Is she pretty?" asked another. "Well, it is scarcely likely that my father would select anything bad for me," was the answer. One related with considerable ill temper that a servant girl who had only been a short time in his family had rejected his advances, that his father, however, had very soon brought the girl to reason by saying, "Have I not engaged you as general servant? Very well, then, this is included in your duties." And the universal assent of his listeners proved that they all regarded the incident from the speaker's point of view and approved of the way it had been dealt with. So it seems while they accuse us of exploiting youth and going after each other's wives, they're the ones that are doing it en masse.
Calling human trafficking one of the greatest human rights abuses of our time, Canadian journalist and social activist Victor Malarek, and I don't know if he's a Jew or not, but he seems to be, addressed the Jewish community at a Montreal synagogue Thursday. Promoting a book he has written on the subject, Malarek said, "Destitute Third World and Eastern European females as young as 12 are tricked into leaving their homelands with promises of wealth and prosperity in the West, as well as Israel. Instead, they are sold into the sex trade by organized crime, gangs, pimps, and brothel owners." There's only one so-called Western democracy with a serious problem in sex slavery right now.
Mm.
And that's Kyrgyzstan or Israel. It's the only one that has this serious problem with sex slavery. And 90% of our pornography is produced by Jews, and most of our child pornography is produced by Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, you know, Catholic priests get all the bad press, but rabbis on a if you go by the numerical proportions, are probably 40 times greater involvement in sexual offenses.
Absolutely. I found a website that lists about 1,000+ rabbis that they know of that have been convicted, charged with, or copped plea agreements to various sex charges, most involving children. And you consider how many rabbis can there be in the world?
Well, right. And when a Catholic priest is found to be guilty of these things, it's all over the news.
Mm.
But you never hear about a rabbi. And when you do, it's just a little blurb and it's gone the next day. But when it's a Catholic, it's on and on and on.
I'd like to read one paragraph from Mein Kampf, if that's all right. "The black-haired Jewish youth lies in wait for hours on end, satanically glaring at and spying on the unsuspicious girl whom he plans to seduce, adulterating her blood and removing her from the bosom of her own people. The Jew uses every possible means to undermine the racial foundation of a subjugated people. In his systematic efforts to ruin girls and women, he strives to break down the last barriers of discrimination between him and other peoples. The Jews were responsible for bringing Negroes into the Rhineland, with the ultimate idea of bastardizing the white race, which they hate, and thus lowering its cultural and political level so that the Jew might dominate. For as long as a people can remain racially pure and are conscious of the treasure of their blood, they can never be overcome by the Jew. Never in this world can the Jew become master of any people except a bastardized people. That is why the Jew systematically endeavors to lower the racial quality of a people by permanently adulterating the blood of the individuals who make up that people." And that's absolutely why the Jews are using every means at their disposal, be it pornography, feminism, encouraging men to become lecherous skirt chasers, just abducting the women and the young girls off the street, or even the young boys as well, and just sending them to God knows where, Brazil, Venezuela, Israel.
And that's the way that that they acted in Weimar Germany in the 20s. They mm-hmm. tried to do it in an open society. And when Hitler stood in the way, they destroyed Germany. And nobody stood in the way here, and they got their way here. We got Roe versus Wade. We got birth control on demand, abortion on demand. We got the sexual revolution and the feminist revolution. And it was all about liberating white women to debauch them. That's what it was all about. And here nobody stood in the way, so here we are.
So they've basically been liberated from the protection and stability offered by the family.
Well, right, by the family and by a normal social structure and a normal marriage you know spouse selection and marriage process.
And they used their fifth column Negroes, basically to burn down city after city whenever the white man objected to what was going on. If there was an objection, Cleveland gets burned to the ground. If there's another objection, Los Angeles is gone. So eventually whites just capitulated.
Well, nobody stood up. Nobody cried foul. Nobody even cared about what was going on because, what's another plank of the protocols of Zeon? We will create distractions. And that's exactly what they've done. And here, I mean, that's pretty easy to do. Just throw a couple of football games up on television every week, and nobody cares about what's happening to their daughters. They're watching football.
You know, I'd say it's not for nothing that South Africa lasted longer than the U.S., since TV really didn't become widespread in South Africa until the closing years of the 70s. Were you aware of that, sir?
No, I didn't. But, well, as soon as the 70s closed, South Africa went down the drain.
Mm-hmm. Well, it began. It began a long, steady decline, probably starting in the late 70s when they began repealing anti-miscegenation laws. But, you know, they lasted probably a good 30 years longer than we did in the U.S., probably because they didn't have the poisonous influence of television in their daily lives. All right, shall I go ahead and read number 22?
I'll read 22. You read 21.
All right.
Mr. Alston to Mr. Balfour. Now, Mr. Alston has filed many of these reports, but he's a diplomat whose name comes up here often. This is from Vladivostok. January 14th, 1919. I have received the following from consul at Ekaterinburg, dated the 13th of January. The number of innocent civilians brutally murdered in Ural towns runs into the hundreds. Officers taken prisoners by Bolsheviks here have had their shoulder straps nailed into their shoulders. Girls have been raped. Some of the civilians have been found with their eyes pierced out, others that without noses, while 25 priests were shot in Perm, and the bishop, Andronic, was buried there alive. Now that's another plank of the protocols of the learned elders of Zeon, is to destroy religion and to basically outlaw Christianity. And they're doing that here very slowly. It's taking a lot of time, but anybody with any sense to observe what's happened from the 1950s until today with these hate crime laws, they've tried to outlaw Christianity without ever calling it that, without ever stating or admitting as much. But basically, that's what they're doing.
That's the end result of all their policies. All their policies carried through their natural conclusion is the obliteration of Christianity and the replacing of it with some sort of Jewish materialism.
Exactly. And in the Bolshevik Revolution, they just rounded the priests up and shot them.
They were very overt about it, since they were able to be.
Yes, they were. Here it's the long march, the slow march. Okay, you would read 23.
All right, I just wanted to read a quote or two from protocol number 14. When we come into our kingdom, it will be undesirable for us that there should exist any other religion than ours of the one God, with whom our destiny is bound up by our position as the chosen people, and through whom our same destiny is united with the destinies of the world. We must therefore sweep away all other forms of belief. If this gives birth to atheists whom we seek today, it will not, being only a transitional stage, interfere with our views, but will serve as a warning for those generations which will hearken to our preachings of the religion of Moses, that by its stable and thoroughly elaborated system has brought all the peoples of the world into subjection to us. So that they don't really care if atheism takes off. In fact, they'd prefer it, since every person that becomes an atheist is taken away from Yahweh.
And everybody, every white nationalist who's an atheist or who's a pagan is just playing into the hands of the Jews. And any white Christian who believes for one second that the Jews are the people of the Old Testament has played into the hands of the Jews. They're all just whores for the Jews. They're all just pawns.
Well, here's a quote from Goldwin Smith, Jewish professor of modern history, Oxford University, October of 1981. We Jews regard our race as superior to all humanity and look forward not to its ultimate union with other races, but to its triumph over them. And haven't they essentially, they've triumphed over the entire world, haven't they? Their father Satan is the prince of this world, and he has left them as the administrators of his fiefdom, basically, hasn't he?
Well, right, and you know, the only way that that they've gotten away with it is because Christians listen to these Baal priests, these Jew whore priests, and when I say that, I count John Hagee and Oral Roberts and all of those clowns right in with them, and do not read their New Testament. Read your New Testament. There is no way, even with the King James translation, there is no way a Christian can come to the conclusion that he should embrace the Jews.
And the great promise of Scripture is that the kingdom will be taken from these usurpers and given back to us, because if it were not so, then the seed of Adam would be wiped from the face of the earth and the Jew would triumph.
Well, right. And this is all part of Yahweh's plan, and Yahweh's going to let them get away with what they're going to be allowed to get away with. That's the way it is.
All right, number 23, General Knox to War Office, received January 16, dispatched, telegraphic, Omsk, January 15, 1919. An officer has just returned from a few days' visit to Perm. Before the revolution, he was employed at Perm. He states that he arrived there on 28th December. The town was captured by the Bolsheviks on the 24th, and they fed no one except those in their employ. He says he was unable to recognize his old acquaintances, as their cheeks were sunken, their faces were yellow, and they looked like palsied old men. The Bolsheviks have raised a battalion of 700 officers, but they will have to be fed for several weeks before they are in a condition to fight. Starvation will, he says, claim half the population of the towns before June if Bolshevism is not stamped out in Russia. The peasants hate the Bolsheviks owing to constant requisitions, but they are better off. The peasants will only sow sufficient for their own needs for next harvest. He is of opinion that Bolsheviks will not be suppressed without the use of outside force, as anti-Bolshevik classes are too enfeebled by hunger to make any effort. There are, of course, numerous murders. There was one commissary who used to have a dozen prisoners out every night, and before loading by ball carriage, made the firing party snap their rifles at them 10 or 12 times. As the educated workmen have been taken away by the Bolsheviks, the chances of the factories producing anything for several months is negligible. It is difficult to bring coal from the Ural Mountains, as the bridges over the Chusabraya east of Perm have been destroyed. Is it possible that public opinion in allied countries will allow Bolsheviks to continue this wholesale murder? They will, moreover, increase in strength as Russians have to serve them or starve. This matter is not one that only concerns Russia, as the food supply of the whole world is affected.
Well, how many common people you think in England would have heard any of what these reports are being returned to England?
I'd have to say less than 2 or 3%.
Well, right. I'm sure that some rumors got back or some accounts from travelers, and then those accounts were probably circulated as rumors, or so-and-so's uncle. So-and-so's uncle came back from Krakow and he saw this going on or that going on or whatever. But
no.
I'm sure that the English government, that Balfour, who himself was a Jew, just isn't going to let this get around. It's not going into the Daily Mail, that's for sure.
You can call me an anti-Semite, but were I a newspaper owner back then, this would have been front page news every day until it was resolved.
Well, right, but how many Christians own newspapers even then?
They've basically all been bought up in Britain well before they were bought up in the United States, hadn't they?
I'm not really positive, but I would say that Reuters, I know that Reuters in the from at least the 1920s, so probably even longer than that, controlled all of the news going from between Europe and the United States. All of the news about Nazi Germany, all of the news about Soviet Russia, all of the news about fascist, you know, Mussolini's regime, about the Civil War in Spain, and everything from the continent went through Reuters. They had exclusive control.
Reuters was founded by a Jew.
Well, of course it was.
His birth name was Israel Bere Yosefet. So it looks like in 1850, when Reuters was founded, it was Jewish from day one.
Right. Well, they were the newswire from London to New York. in London and Washington. That
and then he was given the rank of a baron by Queen Victoria. Isn't that lovely? All right, then. Would you like to read 24?
Happens all the time that they've taken over the entire nobility now in Britain. Well, not the entire, but I'm sure 2/3 of it at least. Mr. Alston again to Mr. Balfour, Vladivostok, January 18th, 1919. I have been given the following information by a member of the Red Cross mission. So we see the Red Cross is operating in Bolshevik Russia. Dr. T, he's left unnamed, who has just returned to Vladivostok from the neighborhood of Perm. He says that for rank barbarous brutality, the horrors which he has witnessed of Bolshevik legacies in the localities which they evacuated, the tortures and mutilations performed on wounded and others before death, baffled description. Even the ferocity of Turks in Armenia cannot be compared with what is now being done in Russia by the Bolsheviks. Dr. T understands the Russian point of view, as he has been in actual contact with Bolshevism. When I asked him to furnish more precise details, he told me it was difficult to furnish the dates, exact spots, and names, etc. The report from Ekaterinburg of the brutal murder of hundreds of innocent civilians at Perm, of the mutilation of priests, and of tortures, such as officers having their shoulder straps nailed into their shoulders, is, however, absolutely confirmed by him. Dr. T found on the battlefield during fighting in Usuri District, July 1918, bodies of Czech soldiers in frightful state of mutilation, their private parts cut off, their heads cut open, their faces slashed, their eyes gouged out, and their tongues cut out. A doctor of the HMS Suffolk attended four of such cases, which were brought to Vladivostok for official investigation. Right, who's going to investigate the Bolsheviks? These mutilations were inflicted before death, according to the verdict given. The local representative of the Czech National Council, Dr. Girsa, and his assistant state that over a year ago, hundreds of officers were shot at Kyiv when Bolsheviks captured that city. Premier Rodzianko was shot, and the massacre of Prince Yashusin was a brutal murder. In the face of bitterest cold, these men were taken from their homes and thrown into automobiles and carts, and, except for their caps, were made to strip naked. In the biting cold, they were forced for hours to stand in line, and Bolshevik soldiers were given liberty of shooting them in groups or singly, as it pleased their fancy. Now, isn't this what the Jews were saying about Nazi Germany? That they were herding people to firing lines and making them stand outside all winter and then shooting them?
I've read some books. When I was at Gerald's, I rifled through several books, and one was a Jewess giving her account of what the SS did to her, and she claims that they searched her, they probed her, saying that she was hiding money in her genitalia, and all these outlandish claims, and that they were basically making all sorts of sexual remarks to her, and that they were telling her what they were going to do to her, and they made her and her friends do like calisthenics when they were naked in the prison yard, and it just seems like some Jewish, basically, for lack of a better term, it sounds like a Jewish masturbation fantasy.
Well, right, it does. It sounds like some of those really bad B-movies, huh?
I mean, it sounds like one of those 1970s Holocaust movies that we've talked about when we were discussing perverted Jewish films. But it seems that they project all of their crimes and all of their attributes onto other people.
Absolutely.
When Freud talked about projection, if he was referring to the people that he most likely interviewed, fellow Jews, well, he hit the mark. He was right on.
Well, right. And I'm sure Freud wasn't lying about everything, because he had a lot of perverted psychology, because it came from a perverted mind, which is part of a perverted race.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure most of the people he interacted with were Jews, fellow perverts.
I'm sure.
So it's one pervert commenting on other perverts.
Dr. Girsa was surgeon civilian in hospital number 12 at this time. This hospital was crowded with patients on account of the ruthless manner in which the Bolsheviks were attacking the more educated classes and the officers in the city of Kyiv. It was necessary to hide officers in closets, even when mortally wounded, to prevent the Bolsheviks coming in and taking them out to be shot in the streets. Many seriously wounded were taken from Kyiv hospitals and ruthlessly murdered in the streets. Bolsheviks forced into the streets and shot men with abdominal wounds, broken limbs, and other grave injuries in other parts of their bodies. He recollects seeing officers being eaten by dogs in the streets of Kyiv. The wife of Dr. Gierse's assistant herself saw an automobile load of frozen bodies of dead officers being carried through the streets to a dumping ground outside of the town. These men were forced out of their homes in the middle of the night. Now that's definitely a Jewish hallmark. That's definitely how they operate. That they even seize Christ in the middle of the night. That's how they operate. Yeah. Hospital beds were emptied. Patients who were seriously ill were ruthlessly slaughtered, and men shot without mercy and without trial. A surgeon in the employment of the Red Cross in Vladivostok verified these accounts. He himself saw such crimes and fled from the vicinity of Moscow in terror with his wife. Photographs of murdered civilians were shown to me and probably later used for Holocaust propaganda.
Well, you know, I've actually found evidence that they have used pictures of bodies from the firebombing and absolute obliteration of Dresden, passing off the victims of the bombing of Dresden in 1945 by the British and Americans as Holocaust bodies.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that most of those... I would bet nearly all of the so-called Holocaust films of bodies piled up are probably from Hamburg and Dresden and the other German cities. Let's put it this way. I have never seen a picture of a Holocaust victim with a yarmulke on. Have you ever seen a dead body in a pile with a yarmulke on?
No, but I did see one that they said was a pile of Jews, but one of them was wearing a Wehrmacht jacket. So I wonder, would the SS hand a Jew that they're about to shoot a Wehrmacht jacket, tell him to put
right.
it on and then shoot him?
I've never seen a pile of Holocaust victims with yarmulkes. All right, you want to read number 25?
All right. Number 25, Colonel Wade to British Peace Conference Commission, Paris and Foreign Office, dispatched Warsaw, January 19, 1919. Number of Korean and Chinese units is reported to be increasing by persons arriving from Ukraine and Soviet Russia. Sole object of these units is plunder, as they are merely bandits and not a regular army. Gravity of situation created by this new development cannot be sufficiently emphasized. End report. And I imagine here in the United States, we will probably see a veritable deluge of Mexicans that cross the southern border into this country simply to rape, loot, pillage, and take whatever they can within 5 or 10 miles of the border and then go back into Mexico. Would you expect such a thing to happen, sir?
Right. And you know, that does happen here, and often they take people back with them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of kidnappings in Arizona by Mexicans crossing the border for raids, cross-border raids. They do cross-border home raids and things like that.
I'm saying it's only going to get worse, though, especially if we have a Bolshevik-style revolution. We may even see uniformed regular Mexicans operating in platoon or company-sized formations crossing the border, and they'll attack places such as Corpus Christi, Laredo, Texas, Phoenix, Tucson, Yuma.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt. Mexico, if we ever had a major civil unrest in this country, we will have huge problems from Mexico, and it won't be from the drug dealers. It will be from the regular army and the so-called police.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt.
Absolutely.
Report number 26. This is another description of what happened in Perm, taken from a collection of reports by the British at Ekaterinburg. Perm is actually Perm is the easternmost city of Europe, and it's today it has a population of about 1.2 million, and it's the sixth largest city in Russia, and the second largest city in the Urals. during the Soviet regime, the city was called Molotov, after the Stalin's Minister of Foreign Affairs. Mr. Alston, again, to Earl Curzon, Vladivostok, January 23rd, 1919. Following statements respecting Bolsheviks in Perm and neighborhood are taken from reports sent by His Majesty's Council at Ekaterinburg. The Omsk government has similar information. The Bolsheviks can no longer be described as a political party holding extreme communistic view. They form relatively small, privileged class, which is able to terrorize the population because it has a monopoly both of arms and of food supplies. So basically what he's saying is that the Bolsheviks really only traded one elite for another. And it seems that the Russian people were doing much better under the first elite than they are under the Jewish elite. This class consists chiefly of workmen and soldiers and included a large non-Russian element such as Letts, Lithuanians, and Estonians, and Jews. The latter are specifically numerous in higher posts. Members of this class are allowed complete license and commit crime against other sections of society. The army is well disciplined, as a most strict system especially is applied to it. It is generally said that officers are forced to serve because their families are detained as hostages. The population of Perm was rationed, and non-Bolsheviks received only 1/4 pound of bread a day, which isn't much. The peasantry suffered less, but were forbidden under pain of death to sell food to anybody but the Bolsheviks. The churches were closed, many priests were killed, and the bishop was buried alive. This and other barbarous punishments, such as dipping people in rivers until they froze to death. Those condemned to be shot were let out several times and fired at with blank cartridges, the sick Jewish mind, never knowing when the real execution would take place. Many other atrocities are reported. The Bolsheviks apparently were guilty of wholesale murder in Perm, and it is certain that they had begun to operate a plan of systematic extermination. On a lamp above the building were the words, "Only those who fight shall eat." Of course, only those who fight for the Bolsheviks shall eat.
It sounds like their often repeated claim that the Germans kept telling them work makes you free, and they won't get off that kick.
Right. Right. Systematic extermination in Perm. And that's what they accused the Nazis of, and they did it. They're the guilty ones. Long before the Nazis. And they took all those crimes and projected them right on the Nazis. There's no doubt. Everything the Jews did in Russia, except the gas chambers. I haven't read anything in the Russian number one reports about gas chambers yet. I guess they had better technology in 1939. Or actually the Holocaust. The Jews claim, I think 1942 or 43 is the year they claim it started.
They claim it was planned in 42 and they began implementing it.
But, which is actually even more incredible. That 6 million Jews were killed in 2 years.
And not only killed, but they were disposed of such that no remains can be found.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I want to know where the teeth are, because the teeth don't burn in crematories, and there's got to be 180 million Jewish teeth floating around somewhere.
Well, I'd like to know too. I've spoken with people that operate crematoriums, and I've read some articles. Those things typically you can operate. I think it takes a few hours per body, and typically after 1 day of heavy use, you'll need to shut it down, do preventative maintenance, clean it, and it'll be down for about another day. So you just can't run it continually, or it will break.
Well, right. There's no way. I'm sorry. I can't think of the name of the book right now. I'm just lost. But Germar Rudolph, he put together what I think is the one work on the Holocaust that everybody should have. and Dissecting the Holocaust is what it's called. Everybody should have, it's a collection of essays from various scholars, and it's just excellent.
And I'd have to say that had they been cremating bodies, they'd probably still be doing it today, and they wouldn't be done with the 6 million.
Well, no, absolutely not. And I want to know where the 180 million teeth are, because 180 million teeth, I mean, that's a lot of teeth. They just can't disappear. I'm sorry. All right, you want to read number 27?
You think we need to read 27? It deals with some issues we've already dealt with about the collapse of the fuel, the various industries falling apart. I think we would be okay to jump forward to 31, which deals with the impact on children and the cultural issues. It's your call, though.
There's something here that I really wanted to get to because it draws a it would lead one to complacency, I think. And, 32, report 32. I got to read 32.
Oh, well, I wanted to do 31, and then we could get into 32.
Okay, go ahead.
31, interviews with Mr. A and Mr. B, who left Moscow on January 21, 1919. Mr. A and Mr. B, two British subjects who left Moscow on 21st January, were interviewed at the Foreign Office on 10th February about present conditions in Moscow. Mr. B, who was a teacher in Moscow Secondary School, the Practical Academy, quote-unquote, gave the following information about conditions in the school in which he taught. This school was typical of many others. Each class has its committee, and as a rule, the most popular boy is chosen to represent the others at the master's meetings. The objects of the committees are, one, to control the masters, two, to arrange about the distribution of food, all the boys and girls in the school being given a midday meal. This is, as a matter of fact, the only reason that they go to school at all. Both boys and girls are herded together, and there is no semblance of morality. The entire absence of discipline in this connection is having an extremely bad effect on the coming generation. In the classes, all semblance of discipline has been destroyed. The children do exactly as they like, sometimes walking out in the middle of a lesson. This is especially the case in the lesson before the midday meal, as they are all anxious to get the first places. No punishments, no homework, and no marks are allowed.
Sounds like America in the 70s.
Sounds like America today.
Well, yeah, but I mean, this started in the 70s.
You mean with the don't give homework, you can't grade them, don't punish them?
Oh, yeah, all that started in the 70s.
All right. The attendance is abominable, the children coming and going just as they think fit. It is impossible to keep order, and classes are simply like a bear garden. If a master does not happen to be popular, the boys turn him out. Sometimes a master may go to a class to give a lesson, only to find the boys holding a committee meeting which must not be disturbed. At Kolomna, between Moscow and Kazan, a boy aged 18 was appointed commissar of the whole school, being in charge of all the teachers. This sounds like Isaiah 3:12, that women are their oppressors and children rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err and destroy the way of thy paths. Truly, society today in America is being oppressed by children now more than ever, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. There's no doubt. I mean, children are suing their parents. My brother's niece called the cops on my sister-in-law.
Well, that's despicable.
Yeah, this is 5 or 6 years ago, but it's just incredible. It's incredible the things kids get away with.
I've heard of some kids that say if their parents won't let them play video games, they'll call social services or they'll call the police, and I'd just say, you know, if I had kids like that, I'd tell them you better.
The school's trained kids to do this.
Yeah, I'd tell them that they better get an ambulance because they're going to need it.
Exactly. And the schools train kids to do this. They train kids to
hate their parents.
Well, not only to hate their parents, but to despise any discipline coming from their parents and use threats to forestall it.
Well, I found a video online, some popular comedy skit run by some Jews. It's a song called Get a New Daddy, and it shows a bunch of kids sitting around a Jew playing the guitar, and he's singing about how if your daddy won't let you stay up real late, you know, you can get rid of him, and here's the easy way to do it. And they just said, just go to school and tell the teacher that your daddy likes to touch your special parts, and then you'll get a new daddy. And then the whole song continues like that, and then it tells you how to get rid of your mom.
Yeah, well, that's I guess that's approved hate speech. You know, that's good because some Jew's spewing it.
Encouraging,
that's good filth.
Encouraging children to bear false witness is okay.
But you know, quoting the Bible that homosexuals should die is hate speech, and some Jew telling kids that, yeah, you know, they could lie about their parents molesting them, that's okay. That Jew should be just be taken out and hung in the public square.
On one
of that's revolting. It's absolutely repulsive. That's the word I'm looking for.
On one occasion, he closed the school for a whole week because one of the masters gave the boy a bad mark. The universities suffer from the same lack of discipline. Any boy of 16 years of age is entitled to enter the university without showing any certificate, so that even if a boy is unable to read or write, he can still enter the university.
Well, we have that today. It's called sports programs.
Absolutely. The Bolsheviks have advertised far and wide the benefits of the new proletarian culture. The above facts throw an interesting light on the way it works in practice. Mr. A, who is a Moscow man, gave the following information about 1, the terror, 2, conditions in factories with which he was acquainted, 3, the shops in Moscow. Part 1, the terror. Executions still continue in the prisons, though the ordinary people do not hear about them. Often during the executions, a regimental band plays lively tunes. The following account of an execution was given to Mr. A by a member of one of the bands. On one occasion, he was playing in the band, and as usual, all the people to be executed were brought to the edge of the grave. Their hands and feet were tied together so that they would fall forward into the grave. They were then shot through the neck by Lettish soldiers. When the last man had been shot, the graves were closed up, and on this particular occasion, the band man saw the grave moving.
Now, this
not being
is
able,
exactly what they accused Nazi Germans of doing.
Not being able to stand the sight of it, he fainted, whereupon the Bolsheviks seized him, saying that he was in sympathy with the prisoners. They were on the point of killing him, but other members of the band explained that he was really ill, and he was then let off. Among the prisoners shot on that occasion was a priest who asked permission to say a prayer before being shot, to which the Bolsheviks replied, iconically, nay, nato, it is not necessary. 2, conditions in factories. At the principal factory at Kolomna, a town on the Moscow and Kazan Railway, there are only about 5,000 workers out of the normal total of 25,000. The factory is run by a committee of 3, one workman, one engineer, and one director. Here, as everywhere, all the workmen are discontented and would much prefer the old management. The situation is intolerable. Nobody works and nobody wants to work, while the one and only topic of conversation is food. All the people are discontented because they have not got enough to eat. At Domodedovo, near Moscow, the fine cloth factory was still working before Christmas, but the output was estimated at 5% of the normal. The factory
Who would want to work? Who would want to work if you have no prospect of enjoying the benefits of your labor?
Absolutely. They're just stolen from you by commissars.
That's what socialism does.
It destroys the incentive.
Even the soft brand of socialism that we have in our union-run plants here, it destroys the incentive to work.
Since everybody's promoted on union timetables based on seniority instead
of
merit.
Right, and nobody can be fired because of the strength of the unions. Bad workers can't be fired or disciplined. Their pay is by how many years that they're on the job, and that's
so all you have to do is get hired. Don't rock the boat. Don't sexually harass or assault a coworker, and you keep your job. And 10 years later, you're a manager.
Well, exactly, and it's been well. You're never going to be a manager, but you'll be a shop steward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been that way. The history of unions. I mean, there was a time and a place where capital had to be coerced into operating fairly and treating its employees fairly.
But we're well beyond that.
Well, yeah, we've been beyond that for 50 years, and the unions have just gone off into Marxism.
Well, I'd say, you know, back in the day when your bathroom break consisted of a 12-year-old boy walking by with a coffee can and going up and down the assembly line, that's when you need, you know, organized labor power, but we don't have that anymore, so we don't need it anymore.
Exactly.
All right. The factory was run by a committee of workmen, but the owner used to meet the committee occasionally to discuss the working of the factory with them and to give them advice. All the workmen were discontented with the way in which the factory was run, and most of them wanted the old managers back again. But as long as the Bolsheviks pay the men high wages, they will stay there, though they do practically no work at all. They have to pretend to be Bolshevik, but in reality, they are not in sympathy with them at all. 3. Shops in Moscow. No shops are open at all except Soviet shops. The Bolsheviks close down certain shops, take down the signs, and remove all the material without paying for it. They then put up signs of their own announcing the sale of clothing, which they sell at twice the price which was charged at the shop from which they took the stuff. No new stuff is now being made at all. What is now being sold is entirely old stock. End report.
Well, that's what it does. They destroyed all incentive. And we haven't, you know, come to the, I don't even know if these reports run into the next summer in 1920, when there's no harvest, basically.
Well, these reports stop in April 1919 when the packet was published.
Right. But they're, you know, there's already many hints throughout these reports that the peasants just aren't really going to plant anything the next season.
Mm-hmm.
Because the communists will just come take it. The Bolsheviks will just come take it.
Well, why work if it's going to be stolen?
Well, exactly. There's no reason to work. Okay, report number 32. Now this report in this group, it was sort of disturbing because it supposedly comes from a Frenchman recently departed Petrograd. And to me, it seems to offer some sort of false hope in various ways. First, by saying alternatively that the Bolshevik regime was weakening and expected to fall, mostly due to a lack of provisions among their supporters, or that the Bolshevik regime was softening and seeking a more moderate position. That seems to be the impression that this report left me with, that it may even be a plan. I don't know. I don't like this report. Of course, neither of the avenues presented in this report turn out to be true. And I think that reports such as this would have the effect of discouraging the British from any remedial action or intervention. The report does state, however, that the Bolsheviks were, well, I'm going to read it, comprised chiefly of Jews and Germans. But I also perceive that the reporter may have mistaken some German-speaking Jews for real Germans. All right. Report number 32. Lord Kilmarnock to Earl Curzon, Copenhagen. So he's nice and safe and out of the way. February 3rd, 1919. I have the honor to report that a French gentleman who left Petrograd towards the end of January has given me the following information as regards the situation in Russia. MF, he's known as, was of the opinion that the military and civil power of the Bolsheviks had reached its zenith and was already on the decline. The leaders of the movement had acquired strength first because they held out prospects of limitless pillaging to their followers, and then by reserving for the Red Guard the remaining supplies of food. These supplies were now exhausted, and the money which was so lavishly given to the guards could buy nothing. When the workmen were discontented in the past, the Bolsheviks had been able to quell disorder by making a distribution of flour, but now they could offer nothing to the workmen except depreciated rubles. The lack of arms and ammunition was becoming serious, and the frequent desertions, especially of the peasant soldiers, had a demoralizing effect on the army. So we'll just bring in more Chinamen. They eat anything, so it doesn't matter whether they have food or not. The Bolsheviks comprised chiefly Jews and Germans, who were exceedingly active and enterprising. The Russians were largely anti-Bolshevik, but were for the most part dreamers, incapable of any sustained action, who now, more than ever before, were unable to throw off the yoke of their oppressors. Night after night, now notice he doesn't say day after day. Now, night after night, the counter-revolutionary societies held secret meetings to plot against the Bolsheviks, but never once was a serious attempt made to carry through the conspiracy. The starving condition of the people paralyzed their willpower. The country was in a complete state of anarchy. When Petrograd said yes, Moscow said no, and neither were able to impose their will at all on the local Soviets in the provinces, though the Soviet at Moscow was especially especially, was endeavoring to establish its hold over all the country. There were no newspapers except those printed in Moscow, which were full of lies. Now that's also a, to take a slight departure, that is also in the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, that the media would print nothing but lies.
And isn't that what they're doing?
Well, yeah, that's what they do today in America. And that's what they did in Bolshevik Russia. But I mean, they do it today in a much softer way.
May I read one portion of that protocol? That's protocol number 12. We will control the press. Point 4. Not a single announcement will reach the public without our control. Even now, this is already being attained by us, inasmuch as all news items are received by a few agencies in whose offices they are focused from all parts of the world. These agencies will then be already entirely ours and will give publicity only to what we dictate to them.
And that's exactly what's gone on. And that's exactly what we've had the last 100 years.
And that's why no one in Britain knew about the Bolshevik Revolution.
And certainly nobody in America. And that's why nobody in America knew what was really going on in the Weimar Republic. Okay. There were no newspapers except those printed in Moscow, which were full of lies. And they claim that the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion are a forgery, right?
Well, if it is a forgery, it's the best darn forgery I've ever seen.
It's absolutely prophetic, isn't it? Can Satan be a prophet?
And I'd like to point out, too, that they've never said until recent years that it's a fake. They've always said it's a forgery, and strictly speaking...
Well, right, somebody copied it from a rabbi.
As I said to some Jews online, I'm certain the rabbi didn't authorize the copy, thus it's a forged copy. It's an unauthorized copy of a genuine.
Absolutely. Okay, back to this report. Railway communications were coming to an end, and strikes were a frequent occurrence. In Petrograd, practically all the factories were idle, and in the Moscow district, but few were still working. As an example of the commercial apathy into which the country had sunk, MF mentioned that the famous, and he won't give the guy's name, mentioned that the famous Putilov works had only turned out one engine in a whole month. The committees of the poor paralyzed all trade, which was further hampered by increasing local jealousies. And it was now practically impossible to move goods or fuel from one quarter to another, or even from one house to another, that they probably come and steal it. The interference of these committees had led to such a state that the peasants had refused to bring in food to the cities, but preferred to bury their small stocks. And though lately the situation had slightly improved, the position was precarious, and he could not see how the population of northern Russia would survive the months of February, March, and April. Fortunately, the weather had so far been mild as no fuel was available. He himself had managed to live on biscuits and sardines, but when he left Petrograd, people had to exist on about half a pound of oats a day. At any moment, even the supply of oats might be exhausted. He said that Bolshevik leaders felt that their days were numbered, and they were trying to introduce into the direction of affairs representatives of the more moderate parties, such as the Revolutionary Socialists, and their program was being modified accordingly. That this is the second reason why I said this report left false hope. The terrorism had lately been less severe, the executions fewer, and many of the Red Guards themselves were being shot on account of crimes which they had committed. And I think this is all propaganda.
Absolutely.
And an effort was being made to carry out the principles of communism on a more ideal basis. And though there was no effective restraint on plundering and thieving on the part of the Red Guards, still it happened now that selfish thieves, i.e. thieves who stole and refused to share the booty with the other guards, were shot by their comrades. Well, that's only normal. MF was quite positive, however, that the interesting experiment of introducing communism had definitely failed. Well, MF was no prophet. Any regime which could offer food to the people would at once gain their support. And any regime, however tyrannical and however corrupt, would be milder and more honest than the present. And I think that report offered false hope that this Bolshevik problem was going to pass quickly. And I understand that some of the English ambassadors early in these reports had hoped that the Bolshevik reign of terror would come to an end. But that was when the White Army was a lot more substantive.
Absolutely. And number 33 makes a few good points, so I'd like to read that. Mr. Alston to Earl Curzon, received February 11, dispatch, telegraphic, Vladivostok, February 8, 1919, following from consul at Ekaterinburg, 6th February. From examination of several laborer and peasant witnesses, I have evidence to the effect that very smallest percentage of this district were pro-Bolshevik, majority of laborers sympathizing with summoning of constituent assembly. Witnesses further stated that Bolshevik leaders did not represent Russian working classes, most of them being Jews. As a result of refusal of 4,000 laborers near Ekaterinburg to support local Bolsheviks, many were arrested and 12 were suffocated alive in slag gas pit, their mutilated bodies being buried afterwards, and 90 peasants taken out of Ekaterinburg prison, where they had been thrown because they objected to Bolshevik requisitioning their cattle, were brutally murdered. End report.
It's an interesting observation that they finally make, that witnesses further stated that Bolshevik leaders did not represent Russian working classes. Mm-hmm. And how do working people ever think that Jews could represent them? What experience do Jews have actually working for a living?
When has a Jew ever earned his keep with the sweat of his brow?
It's very rare.
The only time you'll see a Jew in a field is if he is there looking at land to buy, or if he is telling his employees to work harder and quit complaining.
Or if he's trying to redline the district for an insurance company.
But I've never seen a Jew with a rake in his hand, have you?
Not even growing up in New Jersey where there's a rose in bloom on every street. I mean, it's the Garden State, and I still don't ever think I saw a Jew with a rake in his hand. Number 34, Sir H. Rumbold to Earl Curzon. I don't think I made any notes for this report. It's short. I have the honor to... Well, it's not short because it's attachments. Yeah.
It goes on.
And this attachment's actually pretty good, and I thought I did have some notes. Yes, I do have some notes for it. I have the honor to transmit to your lordship herewith a copy of a letter addressed by Madam X, a Polish lady from Krakow, to a compatriot at Paris. Madam X's letter gives a certain amount of apparently first-hand information relative to conditions in Ukraine, where, according to the writer, the Poles have frequently been the victims of appalling outrages. Enclosure number 34, a letter from Madam X. And this is a Polish woman, and she's writing that this is her letter to another Polish woman or man who she knows, who she's friendly with. And that person is in Paris, and she's writing back to them. And let me say first that at this time in this area, the Makhnovists were operating, and they had something called the Black Army. And they were in the Ukraine and in parts of Poland, and they were anarchists. And we don't hear too much about the Black Army, but the Makhnovists had actually when the Black Army was founded, it was founded by a guy who was a famous anarchist, and he founded it with 15,000 troops. I mean, it was a force to be, that's not a huge army, but it's a force to be reckoned with for sure.
For, for people who don't believe in any government or any sort of order in society, that sure, a well-regimented force, and it takes some organizational skills to get 15,000 people together who ostensibly are fighting for nothing.
Right. And this I'm looking for his name, and I had it here. Well, he had gotten out of prison in 1917. His name was Makhno, M-A-K-H-N-O. And I think he was a Pole by nationality, but he was
probably a Jew.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, but it's possible that he probably was. But he was in the Ukraine, and he was an anarchist. And he set himself up. When he was released from prison in 1917, he set himself up as a sort of like a Robin Hood figure. And he organized this anarchist army known as the Black Army.
But he got the funds out of nowhere. I wonder if Kuhn Loeb and Company transferred him the money.
Well, right. He was probably, you know, he was probably financed by the same people the Bolsheviks were. But it's a part of history that I really didn't know a whole lot about until I looked into it today. And of course, I still don't know a whole lot about it. But it's pretty interesting that he was eventually defeated, I think, in July of 1920.
And could we safely say that as an organized movement, anarchism, the anarchist ideology, is simply a transition between whatever society was previously governed by, be it a constitutional monarchy, a constitutional republic, to the ultimate end goal of Jewish communism? The Jew never intends to use anarchy to abolish the government and then have no government and allow the people to have the most freedom possible and to live under their own set of laws and their own set of local customs. The Jew uses anarchy to organize people that are freedom inclined for maximum freedom, basically just to tear down the government. And then out of that chaos will come the imposed order of Jewish communism.
Well, right. We saw a couple of reports ago where a couple of reports ago we had a statement here that that the Bolsheviks weren't that they weren't the proletariat anymore. They were basically an elite society of their own. They traded one nobility for they traded the Tsarist nobility for the Jewish nobility. Is basically what they did. That's it only took them a year and a half to do that. It's incredible. And they did it through means of anarchy and absolute terror. Okay, let me read this report from this woman, because what we're going to see in this report is very telling. When the Germans had made their way into the Ukraine, there was actually hope in the minds of the Ukrainians. And then the Germans had to withdraw, probably to prop up the front in the west, and all hope for the Ukraine went down the tubes. So I'd like to read this report. January 1917, Krakow. I often wonder if you and our fellow countrymen in Switzerland know anything about the events which are occurring in the unfortunate parts of our country from which we were forced to flee. Now she's talking about Eastern Poland. I imagine very little is known, and yet these regions, although far from the center, are nevertheless in Europe, and are still inhabited by civilized people who are at the present in the most terrible state. Their property is confiscated and pillaged, their lives are often in danger, and they cannot even flee as their retreat is cut off. From October 1917 to February 1918, bands of soldiers and armed peasants pillaged and laid waste the whole of Russia and the Ukraine. All household property, without exception, farms, gentlemen's places, and buildings of every description were burned or pulled down. Forests were cut down without anyone in authority putting an end to this craze for destruction. This is the way the Russian and Ukrainian peasants entered into possession of the lands granted them freely by the Bolshevik government and the Ukrainian government. It is needless to add that nothing escaped being pillaged, not even churches and graves being spared. The unfortunate landed proprietors, as well as the farmers, farm laborers, and workmen in factories, took refuge in the towns in an attempt to save what they could of their belongings. Their pillaging still continued on the plea of carrying out a search. The arrival of the Austro-German armies in February of 1918 put an end to this craze for robbery and rapine. Owners regained possession of their property, of the ruins of their houses and farms, and of what remained of their forests. There was even mention of a commission which would make a valuation of the losses suffered and make those responsible pay for them. However, in the winter of 1918, the Austro-German armies retreated, and a band of bravos resumed the reins of government in the Ukraine, and the land became again the prey of peasants' committees who cannot pillage anything as the country is laid waste and covered with ruins. What is happening now is of a quite different nature and is manifestly anti-Polish. Last year it was landed proprietors that were attacked. Now they want to destroy every Pole regardless of class distinctions, or everything Polish regardless of class distinctions. As I am far away and have little news, my information is certainly somewhat meager, and yet the events that I am going to relate to you were true. In the Proskorow district, the peasants burnt M. Stanislaw Skibuski alive after torturing him for 2 days. I probably tortured his name. Two brothers, Kotskowitz, as well as Mademoiselle Malinowska, were murdered by peasants. Mademoiselle Marie Mankowska and her son have been imprisoned for several weeks, and nobody knows what will happen to them. All the prisons are crammed with Poles who are undergoing the most terrible treatment. Jerome Sobanski and his son are among the prisoners. I guess they both have these people in common. 14 members of Michael Sobanski's government were frightfully tortured before being killed, and the same fate has befallen the members of Bialo Sirkiew's government. At Brykow, 7 members of the Gralchowski government were mutilated before being murdered. In the Bierdozu district, Malazuski, manager of a factory, and Rosinski, sub-manager, were murdered. In Volhynia, the two brothers Plotter of Dombrovka were burned alive. At Kamino, Alexandre Sadowski had been put in prison for a long time, and great anxiety is felt for his life. I'm going to butcher this name. At Chair Pazinsky, the gamekeeper was killed after being frightfully tortured. Catholic priests are exposed to every indignity, and their lives are always in danger. At Bezalia during Mass, 70 people were arrested in church. Now remember the protocols. We will destroy Christianity.
Absolutely.
In the towns, Polish and Russian landowners were arrested and imprisoned. The peasants in the country come to find them, and the prisoners are handed over to them with permission to do what they like with them. It is only by means of very heavy ransoms that they manage occasionally to save their lives. With regard to your own property, speaking to the person that she is writing in France, the house and the farmhouses were still standing last November. Probably not now. Malajowski is destroyed, Malajos is destroyed, and the forests are in a terrible state. At Strykaus, nothing is left standing. Our properties are completely laid waste. Petlura's band has seized the banks as well as the sugar factories, and it is impossible to draw any money or shares belonging to companies without first obtaining the signature of the peasants' committee. And I would doubt that anybody had the gumption to ask. It is also said that half the money in the banks belonging to private accounts has been confiscated. Only half? The other half must belong to Jews. At any rate, it is quite certain that part of the capital belonging to private individuals has been seized at the Union Bank in Kamiznek. If public opinion, as voiced by the European press, has denounced and condemned the excesses and crimes committed in Belgium, Serbia, and the Duchy of Posen, why should the crimes committed by the Bolsheviks and the Ukrainians remain unknown? So there we go. There's the news blackout that we've been talking about. It is the wish of the unfortunate people who ask for the assistance and implore the protection of the Allied armies that France, England, and America should be informed of what is going on. Too bad this Polish woman evidently didn't know that the Jews in France, England, and America didn't want the French, the English, and the Americans to know what was going on. As Warsaw turns a deaf ear, being too much taken up with its political questions, and the Polish armies have enough to do with the Ruthenians in Galicia and cannot give any help to people farther away, we should like our committees in Switzerland to be kept fully informed and to be able to represent to the French and the English press, like they would care, how matters stand. It is with this object in view that I write to you and place myself at your disposal if more information can be sent, which could be published in the press. Well, I guess she was just too naive to know that the press in the West was controlled by the Jews too, and they weren't going to tell on their compatriots.
All right, and Report 35 is mostly just namings of people who were executed, how mass graves were unearthed, and where they were recovered, and how the executions were carried out. Do you think we can just skip over that and get to Report 36, which I think is more worthwhile? It deals with nationalization issues and more of the particulars about the economy, the culture, and daily life.
Well, there's one thing about that's interesting about Report 35, and that's that it describes the atrocities perpetrated by the Bolsheviks in Estonia. But we see from all these other reports that Estonians are fighting for the Bolsheviks in Russia.
Yes.
And, yeah, I think that should be highlighted, but I think it's you know, we should probably leave it for next week.
All right. Well, if you want, I'll read a bit about what they did in Estonia. But I'd also speculate that the so-called Estonians who were actually in Russia taking part in this Bolshevik revolution were most likely Jews from Estonia.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a Jews or there's always a mercenary element.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Do you understand? There's always an element of white people that'll just look out for themselves and try to make a buck and think they could do it fighting somebody else's battles. I mean, that's no doubt. But yeah, I'm sure a lot of them probably were Jews.
And those that died during the revolution fighting the white army, they're probably on some Holocaust wall from the 40s.
Probably. Or their grandparents are in Miami Beach right now playing chess with Osama bin Laden, their grandchildren.
All right, so shall we begin on 35 or shall we jump to 36? It's your call, sir.
Well, it's up to you. I mean, if you want to read one more report, go ahead.
All right, I'd like to read 36. Mr. Alston to Earl Curzon, received February 12, dispatch, telegraphic, Vladivostok, February 11, 1919. I have received the following statements from a British consular official who was at Ekaterinburg in September 1918 regarding the situation in that town during Bolshevik regime from 1917 until the end of 1918 when the town was relieved by the Czechs. Bolsheviks ruthlessly nationalized, that's in quotes, all property during first 4 or 5 months, including British firms like Kontuschim, Seisseret, etc., and they made constant demands of all moneyed merchant classes for huge contributions with penalty of arrest and confiscation of all belongings unless paid promptly.
Well, we've already seen earlier that they nationalized the women, too, already, right? So.
Absolutely, and they tried to nationalize the children.
Yeah.
And I'm sure in practice they did. Businesses of all kinds, banks, and houses were either placed under control of labor elements or nationalized, and to such a low level were industry and manufacture reduced that they practically came to a standstill. Systematic searches of houses and private individuals took place daily, and gold and silver ornaments and even spare clothes were taken without compensation, and merchants who attempted to resist or evade constant decrees from local Soviet were immediately arrested. And as an aside here, I really would like to find data on firearms ownership in Tsarist Russia, but I would have to assume that the Tsar probably implemented various gun ban policies. Otherwise, these peasants would be armed enough that they would be able to resist people coming in their homes, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely.
It would naturally follow. Robberies and murders were frequent. Law and order were at very low ebb, and almost complete anarchy reigned. A local consular corps was formed in March 1918, consisting of consuls and representatives of some dozen different nationalities, to act as an intermediary between Bolshevik Soviet and subjects of foreign powers, owing to the molestation of foreign subjects. All public meetings were suppressed, and with the exception of the daily official organ of the Bolsheviks, no papers or printed matter could be published. Czech movement on Omsk began towards the end of May. We were in a state of siege from the end of May to 25th July, when Bolsheviks finally evacuated the town and the Czechs marched in. Bolshevik terrorism succeeded Bolshevik despotism. Having publicly announced their intention of making Red Terror as dreadful as possible, they arrested hundreds of private citizens as hostages for the sole reason that they belonged to so-called bourgeoisie and intelligentsia. Hotels and private residences were requisitioned to accommodate these hostages, as prisons were full of them. Under armed bands of Red Guards, scores were taken to the front to do work for Proletariat Army and dig trenches. Without semblance of a trial, many of them were shot during June and July. A placard on the wall of one of the gates, which was reprinted in Bolshevik paper the following day, was the first intimation we had of this. This proclamation gave names of 19 citizen hostages who had been shot, amongst whom were the members of a well-known engineering firm, Mr. Fedyev, and the manager of Sesrit Company, an English undertaking, Mr. Makrinosev. The rest were mostly peaceful, hard-working merchants and mostly well-known persons. Eight more were shot a few days later, amongst them being the son of a wealthy flour miller, Mr. Makarov. Number of bodies amounting, I believe, to 60 or more were discovered after Czechs took the town. Subsequently, it was discovered that they were shot in the most cruel manner, just like animals in woods, and some of them were undoubtedly left to die on the ground, as no pains were taken to discover whether their wounds were mortal or not. It was alleged by Bolsheviks that to prevent any counter-revolutionary movement in the town, it was necessary to terrorize population in this manner. Consular corps were informed roughly that Bolsheviks would allow no interference when they protested against these wholesale assassinations. Although they vigorously denied it, Bolsheviks began to evacuate Ekaterinburg about the middle of July. One of their leaders publicly stated that if they were obliged to leave the town, they would massacre 1,000 citizens. 3 days before they finally left Ekaterinburg, Bolsheviks announced at a public meeting on 25th December that they had recently shot the emperor. Their system of espionage was very perfect, and during the whole of their regime, nobody dared to utter a word that might be construed into anti-Bolshevism, as they were liable to be immediately arrested and shot. In addition to the above-mentioned horrors, we were always anticipating an outbreak of typhus, cholera, or other epidemic, as everything was in a state of unutterable filth, no attempts being made to clean buildings, offices, streets, railway stations, or trains. Everybody appeared dejected and depressed, and decent and cleanly dressed people were seldom seen in the streets. Bolshevik evacuation was most thoroughly carried out, and it is estimated that they took with them over 4 billion rubles worth of platinum, gold, stores, and money. There is no doubt that there would have been a great many more murders if they had not been so busily engaged in this plunder, but owing to rapid advance of Czechs, they were forced to hasten their departure. There will be wholesale massacre of moneyed and merchant classes if Bolsheviks succeed in retaking Ekaterinburg. End of report. And it seems interesting that they justify their mayhem, saying that they had to put down counter-revolution, when there's absolutely no evidence that the people were seeking to cut their throats and kill them all in some horribly extrajudicial fashion, as they had been doing to the peasants. Yet when the German Freikorps put down the Bavarian Soviet Republic in 1919 and 1920, when they put down the Spartacist uprising in Berlin, they're regarded as bloodthirsty.
Well, absolutely, and that's the Jew projecting his own thoughts and behavior on everybody else. That's the way.
So the Jew can basically blow the head off a Palestinian 5-year-old who's walking to the store to buy a candy bar, and he calls it defense of his people and defense of Israel. yet the Americans aren't allowed to stop armed gangs of adult Mexicans that want to cross the border and chop people up.
But don't be surprised that the Jew practices the religion laid out for him in the Talmud.
Absolutely.
And the Christian does not practice the religion of Yahshua Christ laid out in the New Testament. Because the Christian is an embracer of the Jew. When we're told to reject them.
And since the Jew is by nature a hypocrite and basically a demon in physical human form, we Christians have become embracers of hypocrisy and embracers of the doctrines of demons.
Well, they're all in bed with the devil. There's no doubt. They are actually literally in bed with the devil. Every Judeo-Christian and basically every non-identity Christian, every non-two-seedline identity Christian is in bed with the devil. There's no doubt in my mind.
And some of them know it, some of them don't know it.
The no-Satan people in identity are in bed with the devil. If you can't read the Russia number one report and see Satan, then you must be sleeping with him.
Or you have some vested interest in not seeing the Satan because you're profiting from it personally.
Absolutely.
All right, then. So next week we will continue where we left off, and I think people will like what we have to say. We've already clearly demonstrated that Russia was prosperous under the Tsar with the book The Third Rome. You've shown that.
Yes.
We've shown
Russia was very prosperous. It was a very forward-moving, mechanized, industrialized nation.
And I think we've adequately shown that they had a great deal of freedom, certainly of association, speech, and press in Russia, since the Bolsheviks were openly meeting. They were publishing their thoughts in their various newspapers, which the secret police were not shutting down. We're told that the Tsarist secret police were brutal and they tortured people and disappeared them. Yet, were this happening, how was Trotsky alive? How was Lenin alive? How were all these revolutionaries alive? How were they alive doing what they were doing? And we've shown that the Russian economy went from functional to absolutely abysmal and deplorable. Living conditions went to basically what Haiti is today.
Absolutely.
And all that happened in several short years.
Well, all the Africans are going to do is export Africa wherever they go. There's no doubt.
And the Jews
are going to bring every one of them here if they can, because they're going to use them against us or try to.
Well, that's why right now they are working on bringing upwards of, I believe it was, they want to bring at least 50 million Negroes into Western Europe in the next several years as part of a guest worker plan. And they say it will ultimately be increased to over 100 million. They say that they're just going to work there for a season and then go back to Africa with the valuable skills they'll have.
Yeah, right.
I imagine.
Well, they never go back. And even the ones that go back, that even the Africans that are educated in American universities and go back to Africa. With all good intentions, we bring them over here, we put them through one of our schools for 4 years or 8 years, and send them back, and they become dictators, tyrants, and absolutely corrupt World Bank stealing, the typical Negro.
I was about to say that, you know, we train them like we trained all the Central American anti-communists.
And they learn how to be more sophisticated crooks.
Absolutely. We basically educate, the Oxford students of today will become the third world dictators of tomorrow.
Well, you know, most of the African tyrants were educated in the West.
And interestingly enough, they got their early education in missionary schools where they learned about the white man's idea of compassion, love, peace, and brotherhood, and they just turned that around and used it against him to deflect criticism later on when they were ruling their countries in Mugabe fashion or, you know, Mobutu Sese Seko. Or Sam Nujoma, or I could just sit here naming names all night.
Wolves can't possibly ever become sheep. That's just the way
no.
it is.
And a wolf cannot do anything. A wolf cannot help but prey on the sheep, can it?
Well, yeah, that's what wolves do. Wolves eat sheep. That's what they do. Richard Kelly Hoskins, great book. I gave
Absolutely.
It to my kids. Out of six kids, one kid got it.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. I'll see you next week.
All right, next week then. Bye.
Thanks, everybody.